nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So I'm Professor Vlad Shalaev, who is electrical and computer engineer at Purdue University. And we continue our exciting journey into the new emerging world of metamaterials. And today we're going to consider the second part of this series of short series of lectures. And that's going to be focused on negative refractive index materials, nonlinear optics, NLO, that's what it stands for, nonlinear optics in metamaterials. And perhaps one of the most exciting applications of metamaterials so far, which is related to the absolutely unique capability open up with these metamaterials, and specifically the ability to image objects with sub-wavelength resolution. And that's related to so-called superlens and hyperlens effects. And finally, which I just mentioned briefly, the third part of this series, we're going to be focused on clocking and transformation optics. But that will be considered next time. All right, so here is outline. The first three items, that's what we considered in the previous lecture. And specifically, we describe these two basic components of metamaterials, electric metamaterials and magnetic metamaterials. I emphasized how challenging it is to obtain magnetic response in the optical range, because there are no any materials existing in nature which would have a significant magnetic response. And with metamaterials, that situation dramatically changes. And these two ingredients, having electrical and magnetic response, enable us to design and engineer materials with negative refractive index. And that's what we're going to consider next. Although I sound perhaps quite often that how revolutionary this area of metamaterials is, as often happens in the history of science, the things which look really new quite often have been considered in the past by some scientific giants. And this idea of negative refractive index is not an exception. As people in Russia say, new things are quite often well forgotten old things. And I'd like to illustrate this for the case of negative refractive index as well. I was astonished myself, actually, to find out first that quite detailed description of the phenomenon of negative refractive index goes back to 1904. It's more than a century ago. And specifically, it was done by Sir Arthur Schuster, who was German by nature. He was born in Germany, but spent most of his career in the University of Manchester, UK. They tried to lure him back to Germany, but anyway, so he stayed in UK. He was knighted there. He became Sir Arthur Schuster, and he has some quotation from his book, actually, and which clearly indicates that he understood quite deeply the possibility and the phenomenon of a negative refractive index. Sir Horace Lamp considered similar phenomena, but for hydrodynamics. In terms, it's also waves, and there can be also very similar phenomena. I'd like to come back to Sir Arthur Schuster, because another thing I'd like to draw your attention to. The current world is such that we quite often try to sell or even oversell whatever we are doing, because it's all about funding, money. This world is very pragmatic, whether we like it or not. That's the way it operates. And sometimes we find all these flashy words, some kind of very nice terms to package our research in the best possible way. This gentleman who described this absolutely unique phenomenon, which people are so excited about now, 100 years later, described it in a book which was which didn't have title like, for example, Breakthrough in Optics or Modern Optics or Advanced Optics. No, it was actually called simply Introduction to Optics. I'd like to you to appreciate the modesty of this gentleman. I think that's something we need to learn from our peers in the past, so who would make such a wonderful breakthrough and still kind of stay on the modest side. This is a academician Mandelstam, and he was like a scientific hero in the former Soviet Union. He actually was the one who invented what we call now Raman scattering. He did it completely independently from Raman, about at the same time. And some people might disagree with me, but in my personal opinion, he described this phenomenon in deeper way than Raman himself did. But as often happens in science, so somehow Raman's papers were noticed first and got more appreciation, and eventually Raman got the Nobel Prize and all the recognition, although Mandelstam did it absolutely at the same time and independently. Therefore, back in Russia, actually, people don't call Raman scattering, they call it combination scattering, just to give a credit to this person too. The reason I'm speaking of him, because in his lectures at Moscow State University in 1944, he also considered this phenomenon of negative refractive index. And there are pictures, there are drawings which he did, I published, of course, those lectures, where again, which clearly indicate that this gentleman understood the phenomenon very deeply and appreciated. And now we are moving to the kind of modern era of metamaterials and negative refraction phenomenon. This is Professor Wisselager, who published his seminal paper in 1967, which was translated 1 year later to English, where he actually emphasized the very important thing that to obtain negative refractive index, you need to design a material where both epsilon, the electric permittivity, and mu, magnetic permeability, are negative. And he also kind of summarized everything what was known by that time and presented it as really like a new phenomenon and how many applications, interesting, really truly novel applications, can be realized based on this material. But even so, it's like I call it a modern era, and actually he's quite active. We collaborate with him. He recently visited us. By the way, in 2 weeks he will be here again, so you can come and see his lecture. But still, it took 40 years when this idea was reappreciated again. And the reason is for that delay, if you wish. Metamaterials require extremely high-level fabrication, cutting-edge fabrication. And only very recently it became possible to create these materials where you can really design and engineer materials which have both epsilon mu negative, negative refractive index as a result. So it's all very challenging. And before that, it was considered like a nice idea, but what to do with this if there are no materials in nature? Professor Wisselager told me he spent several years trying to find any material in nature which would have these properties, but he failed, and probably there are no such material. They can be only engineered, but that requires very sophisticated fabrication. And finally, Sir John Pendry, who did a number of seminal contribution into this field, including this super lens idea, which I will be discussing later, and many other contributions. His contribution to the field also hard to overestimate. So all those are the heroes, and they are protagonists in this field. Well, let's now come back to the basics and recall that what really follows from the Maxwell's equation in this simple formula, that refractive index squared is given simply by the product of epsilon and mu. And again, epsilon describes coupling to the electrical component of light, and mu describes coupling to the magnetic component of light. And when you find refractive index, you take a square root. And in principle, you shouldn't forget that both plus and minus sign, we can use both signs in front of the square root sign. Okay? And as very simple analysis shows that actually if both real parts of epsilon mu are negative, then we have to take the sign minus. So refractive index can be negative indeed. If you do a little bit more sophisticated, more rigorous analysis, that it turns out that a necessary condition for refractive index to be negative is given by this inequality, where prime stands for the real part. And so you could, let's analyze a little bit this simple inequality. First of all, if you consider all material, natural materials in the optical range, where mu is simply equal 1, because there is no any magnetic response at optical frequencies, or almost no response. So that if mu is equal 1, mu prime is equal 1, you have epsilon prime plus modulus epsilon smaller than 0. We do know that epsilon prime can be negative, as the case for metals, but the real part always smaller than the modulus. Therefore, this inequality never can be fulfilled if you do not have any magnetic response. So if mu is equal 1, then this inequality cannot be fulfilled, which means you cannot obtain a negative refractive index. And that brings us to a very important conclusion that to obtain negative refractive index, we have to create artificial magnetism at optical frequencies. Therefore, it was so important to demonstrate that, yes, indeed, we can make materials which have strong magnetic response in the optical range. That's first conclusion. Second one, that which is interesting to note, that in principle, even if epsilon, even if mu prime is positive, different from 1, we already decided it cannot be equal 1, but positive, you still can have this inequality fulfilled if epsilon prime is strongly negative. So if this is the case, when mu prime is positive, epsilon prime is negative, and this inequality is fulfilled so that the refractive index is also negative, then we call such materials single negative metamaterials, because out of these two parameters, epsilon prime and mu prime, only one is negative. If both of them are negative, epsilon prime and mu prime, then this inequality always fulfilled, right? And this is sufficient condition. There is a difference, of course, between necessary and sufficient condition. So if both are negative, then this inequality is always fulfilled. And then we call this material double negative. One could argue, what is the difference? I mean, if it's easier to make with single negative, let's just make single negative metamaterial. It turns out that if you look at the figure of merit, which is defined as the ratio of real part of refractive index and imaginary part of refractive index, then for double negative index materials, it's larger. And we would like to have the figure of merit as large as possible, because what we have in the denominator and double prime is losses, and we would like to keep losses as small as possible. So for single negative index materials, we typically have figure of merit smaller than 1, whereas for double negative metamaterial, figure of merit can exceed 1, which is good, meaning that the role of losses is smaller. So that's a kind of introduction, and with this picture I'm showing illustrating the idea that such basic things as Snell's law actually starts looking differently in materials with negative refractive index. In the conventional case, when both epsilon and mu prime are positive and the result refractive index is positive, the refraction occurs this way. Well, I'm sorry, so look first at the left picture. In the left picture, you could see that in the conventional case, the refraction occurs according to this case. So this just ray gets slightly closer to the normal, to the vertical, if refractive index in the second medium is slightly larger than in the first medium. However, the story completely changes if refractive index is negative. And then it starts looking this way. You could see that that the refracted beam is kind of on the wrong side with respect to the vertical. Instead of going this way, as it would be in the case of positive index materials with positive refractive index, it goes this way. And that clearly sees that rays start propagate in a different way. I should mention also that that's not the most important thing, because in strongly anisotropic crystals, you can have a similar phenomenon. What is really important here is the following fact, that you see that the energy propagates along this red line, whereas the phase propagates against the pointing vector, against the flux of energy. And this is the key thing about negative index materials. Why it's so? Since wave vector is proportional to the refractive index. If refractive index changes its sign, it means that the wave vector also changes its sign. As a result, the wave propagates, the phase propagates against the flux of energy. So the energy goes this way, whereas the phase counterpropagates. And that's very, very important. That's exactly the thing which results in very interesting phenomena. All right, so having this introduction and explaining what is single negative index material versus double negative index materials, let's move on and see what has been accomplished in this area. Another thing I'd like to reiterate, that because wave vector changes its sign, these three vectors H, E, and K in left in a negative index material form left-handed system because K changes its directions. And therefore, sometimes these materials are also called left-handed materials because these three basic vectors, E, H, and K, instead of forming right-handed system as the as is the case for conventional media, in left-handed materials, they form left-handed system. Instead of going through all the, although not that many, there are actually quite limited number of experiments where negative refractive index was demonstrated, but all this is summarized in this table. So the very first observation of material is with negative refractive index in the optical range was done in two groups simultaneously here at Purdue in my group, and in the group led by Steve Brook at the University of New Mexico. So in our case, we obtain negative refractive index at the telecommunication wavelengths, 1.5 micron, and Steve Brook's group obtained negative refractive index at 2 microns. Please pay attention that in both cases, figure of merit was small, quite small actually, smaller than one, meaning that strictly speaking, it was single negative metamaterial. In other words, epsilon only mu was different from one, but remained positive at the wavelength interest, whereas epsilon was strongly negative, so that negative refractive index, so that refractive index was negative. Next year, which is in year 2006, this situation was dramatically improved, and very important contribution was done by the Karlsruhe group from Germany, led by Professor Martin Wegener. They brought the figure of merit to 3, which is still the state of the art at the wavelength close to the telecommunication wavelengths. They used so-called nano-fishnet structure, which we will consider in a moment. And finally, last year, so we actually brought this double, we obtained double negative index material at 810 nanometers, which is at the border with the visible spectral range. The figure of merit exceeded 1. This is the shortest wavelength so far for double negative index material. And in terms of single negative index materials, so it's close to, it's now 770 nanometers. So the Karlsruhe group obtained it at 780 first, and then later our group obtained it at 770. And this is the state of the art as of now. Of course, people keep working, and we hope eventually to obtain negative refractive index for all the visible range. Now we have it at the border with the visible range. So it's extremely challenging fabrication-wise, but anyway, so we already have this breakthrough. First metamaterial with negative refractive index has been demonstrated, and actually a significant part of that progress has been accomplished here at Purdue. Let me explain this, the idea of this fishnet structure, which turns out to be most efficient so far, and the best results have been obtained with this particular structure. You see, it does look like a fishnet. That explains the name of this structure. It actually combines the idea of these paired strips, which can be used to obtain the magnetic resonance, and that's what we considered in our past, in the previous lecture. This pair of strips, remember, they can support this anti-symmetric current, which results in the magnetic response. And if you add perpendicular to these magnetic strips, pairs of electric strips. Electric strips, we call them electric because they result in a non-resonant negative epsilon. In this case, E is directed along these metal strips. It doesn't excite any resonance. It just results in this negative epsilon in a broad spectral range. And why it's good? Because it's extremely hard to have both epsilon and mu negative at the same wavelengths. Because that if you use two different resonances, electric and magnetic resonance, normally it's extremely hard to accomplish. And the smarter approach here is to have a magnetic resonance based on this magnetic strips, exactly what we did, considered last time, and add some non-resonant contribution, because metals have negative epsilon. Even without any resonance, they, because of the Drude formula, they have negative epsilon. So by combining non-resonant negative epsilon with resonant negative mu, you can get both of them resonant, and as a result, negative refractive index. So that brings us to this fishnet structure. And here you can see the structure which we fabricated here at Purdue. You can see all the sizes. They are very critical. It's very important to keep the right sizes. So what we use, you have here these two layers of silver forming these magnetic and electric strips, pairs of magnetic and electric strips, which are separated by spacer formed by alumina, which is a dielectric and has positive epsilon. And the typical sizes here, you could see it's on the scale of 30, 40 nanometers. Of course, all this type of fabrication, which is time and consuming and expensive, has to be accompanied by simulations, modeling, and that's a big, big effort in our group as well, of course, as in other groups all over the world. And here you could see the results of our simulations for transmittance, reflectance, and absorption. Why all this important? Because if you measure transmittance, reflectance, and absorption and compare it against theory, then you can retrieve these parameters, epsilon and mu, because reflectance and transmittance depend on epsilon and mu. So by comparing theory versus experiment, you eventually can retrieve these parameters, epsilon and mu. That's the way we determine them. And you could clearly see, for example, if we look at the absorption, the black curve, that there are actually two resonances. One resonance is the magnetic resonance, which we are describing, and another resonance is the electric resonance, which I will describe in a moment. So, and solid line here is experiment, and dashed line is simulated results. And you see that the agreement is quite good, and it's very important to have good agreement so that your retrieval procedure would be reliable. And so that's result from our paper published last year, where we demonstrated this double negative metamaterial at the shortest wavelengths, which I mentioned. And to prove that actually these two resonances have a different nature, I'm showing here the displacement current. And you could see that for the magnetic resonance, the displacement current does go in opposite direction in the two strips, as required by the theory, and that's eventually results in this loop current, and as a result, you have this negative magnetic permeability. Whereas if you look at this resonance, then the displacement current in both strips goes in the same direction, and that indicates that the nature of this resonance is electric one. So, but we are focusing at this wavelength. That's exactly the wavelength where we obtain this negative refractive index. Here you can see the field emission scanning electron microscope pictures of our sample, which was fabricated in our group, and specifically my student Shakwan Yen did the fabrication. He's absolutely extremely talented in fabrication. And so, and the results of our retrieval procedure, which allowed us to obtain these parameters, which, as I said, the state of the art for now. So at the 810 nanometers, we have both epsilon mu negative. You could see it here. For permittivity, we have like something around minus 1.5 at 810 nanometers. Whereas for permeability, the blue curve, it's like minus 0.7. Both of them negative. As a result, you have negative refractive index, which is equal minus 1. And figure of merit exceeds 1. So it's double negative index materials at the shortest so far wavelengths. If you change the polarization, then the same material actually shows negative refractive index at even shorter wavelengths, 770 nanometers. But in this case, although epsilon is negative, it's again close to minus 2, mu remains positive, it's like 0.3. It's different from one, but remains positive. As a result, although you do have negative refractive index, which is minus 0.9, the figure of merit is here smaller, 0.7. But that still results in the negative refractive index at the shortest wavelength, so phi gain at 770. As I mentioned, the Karlsruhe group obtained it earlier than us at 780, and that's actually 780 is the border which is divisible. In that sense, they first obtained negative refractive index for the visible range. So it's nice to compete with this wonderful group, the excellent EDIT group, and so sometimes they do obtain first results. Sometimes we are lucky and obtain first result. But the competition is good. It's healthy for the field. Well, here is a summary of these results obtained so far in our group. So we have a double negative metamaterial at the shortest wavelength, which is 810 nanometers. The figure of merit is 1.3, and the transmittance is quite high, 25%. The same material for different polarization actually shows single negative index metamaterial at 770. I should mention another very important experiment, which is indeed relevant and was published last year in Science. That comes from a Caltech group led by Professor Atwater. In this case, in their case, they obtain negative refraction through all the visible. However, there should be made clear distinguish, clear difference that their observation was done not for light per se, but for surface plasmon polaritons in the waveguide. If you remember that for surface plasmon polaritons, we have this dispersion dependence. And if you include losses, actually, it curves here, it bends here, and you have this range where refraction is negative for surface plasmon polariton. That's exactly what was used to obtain this negative refraction for surface plasmon polariton through all the visible. It's a very important, relevant experiment, but still I should make it clear that in this case a negative refraction has been obtained for surface plasmon polaritons rather than for light itself. All right, that's actually summarize what I wanted to describe briefly on the progress accomplished in obtaining negative refractive index. Another very related area is so-called chiral metamaterials. That's also a very interesting area with lots of promises. And let me explain a bit here. Again, coming back to this point, which I also mentioned in the first lecture, that lots of actually beautiful science related to this exciting area has been done long, long ago. And I already mentioned this probably first metamaterial ever introduced by Bose in 1898, and which was reported by Lord Rayleigh to the Royal Society of United Kingdom when he used these twisted jute elements to show this chirality. And it turns out that with metamaterials, you can obtain extremely strong chiral effects, actually record high strong optical activity and other related chiral effects. And that was accomplished last year in two groups. One, again, this Karlsruhe group led by Martin Wegener, and Stefan Linden is another key person in this group. So, and another group is led by Professor Zhulodiev at the University of Southampton. They both use kind of similar structures which have this sense of rotation to demonstrate very strong chiral effects. And to be specific, what they showed, the Karlsruhe group showed strong, extremely strong circular decrease. What it means, they showed that transmittance for left circularly polarized light and right circularly polarized light is very strong, despite the fact that the thickness of the structure was extremely small. They obtained quite significant difference in transmittance between these two circularly polarized lights. And as for the Zhulodiev's group, they obtained extremely strong rotation of the polarization of light. It's another effect related to chirality. And actually, it was really extremely strong. It was like 2,500 per millimeter. If I'm not mistaken, this is like the record high chiral effect. That's all very related to this metamaterial business, and why it's related, because it was shown by Tritikov from Finland and by Sergeon Pandri. It turns out that if you have a strong chiral effect, in some cases it's easier to accomplish negative refractive index. So that's, of course, very related to this field. And let me now move to very exciting applications of these metamaterials, which has to do with nonlinear optics. Since as of now, we have very limited number of metamaterials. Of course, there is no many experiments on nonlinear optics, actually one or two, very few. However, people realize as soon as we will further develop these metamaterials, we could dramatically change nonlinear optics. And nonlinear optics is a very important part of optics. For example, lasers are basically nonlinear optical elements. And although probably you didn't take yet a nonlinear optics course, which is focused on this nonlinear optical phenomena, but I still hope to be able to show the flavor to you that nonlinear optics, in the case of metamaterials, become very different and very exciting. This is the experiment done by, again, the same Karlsruhe group, where they showed that second harmonic generation in these metamaterials formed by this U-shaped type of structures, in the case when you do induce this optical magnetism, which is a key thing for metamaterials, second harmonic generation becomes like two orders of magnitude stronger. You see, when you exploit this unique metamaterial property, namely the ability to support magnetic response, then second harmonic generation becomes two orders of magnitude stronger. Because for this polarization of light, you don't induce any magnetic response, whereas for this one, you do. And you see that in this case, the efficiency of second harmonic generation increases by roughly two orders of magnitude. So this is the first experiment probably in the optical range for nonlinear optical phenomenon in metamaterials. Let me now explain some theoretical work which I have done with my actually former PhD advisor, Professor Popov, who is now in at the University of Wisconsin. And we show that actually this nonlinear optical phenomena look quite different in metamaterials. Why it's so? It's actually quite easy to understand. If you look, for example, at the second harmonic generation, so what it means actually that you send the beam at frequency omega, and in a material, nonlinear material, you obtain a new beam at frequency 2 omega. Two photons from incident beam are combined in a sense and converted into one photon at frequency 2 omega, so that the photon energy is of course conserved, so because h bar omega plus h bar omega gives you 2 h bar omega, so two photons are converted in one at double frequency. But what is also important, not only the photon energy is conserved, of course, so the momentum of photons should be conserved. And because of that, the 2 times wave vector k1, where k1 is the wave vector in the fundamental beam, has to be equal to k2, the wave vector in the second harmonic generation, which simply means that, again, since h bar k gives you a momentum of a photon in the incident beam, so therefore 2 h bar k should be equal h bar k over photon at double frequency. So and to have this full momentum conservation fulfilled, it's clear that k1 and k2 should look in the same direction. So which means that the second harmonic generation propagates in the same direction as the fundamental beam. That's what everybody knows. And what happens, the energy from the fundamental beam gradually decreases because it's converted into the energy in the second harmonic generation. So and that all is described by so-called Menli-Rowe relations, which describe the evolution of energy balance along nonlinear medium. And you could see here that if you consider the sum of the energies between the two beams, it's conserved along the medium. It just energy from the fundamental beam is converted into energy of second harmonic generation, but the sum of the two remains constant. If you look now to left-handed materials where refractive index for the fundamental beam is negative, then the whole story changes. Because refractive index is negative, the wave vector for the fundamental beam looks against the pointing vector, as I pointed out before. So K1 and S1 look in opposite directions. However, since the momentum conservation still should be fulfilled, K2 looks in the same direction as K1. And S2, the pointing vector for second harmonic generation, also looks in the same direction because we assume that refractive index for second harmonic generation is positive. So you have here a quite unusual situation when the second harmonic generation propagates against the fundamental beam. So now it works in the reflected direction. So instead of co-propagating, second harmonic generation goes in opposite direction. And so if you look now at the Mandelbrot relations, that instead of the sum of the energy between the two beams being conserved along the medium, we have here the difference in energies between the two beams is conserved. You see how dramatically this phenomenon is changed when you move from conventional media with positive refractive index to materials with negative refractive index. And you could do actually this analytical analysis. It's not this complicated. And it turns out that for long enough media, you could have conversion 100%, like 100% of energy from the fundamental beam is converted into second harmonic generation, which means it works as like nonlinear mirror. A light at frequency omega is incident into nonlinear medium, and the reflected beam with efficiency 100% goes in the reflected direction at frequency 2 omega. So it works like a nonlinear mirror. I should mention also earlier work done by the group in Australia led by Professor Kifshar and work done by Professor Zahidov here at University of Texas, Dallas. Another very important phenomenon in nonlinear optics, it's so-called parametric amplification. This is Chi2 process, a nonlinear process in which you have a control beam at frequency omega 3, you have a signal at frequency omega 2, and so a third beam is generated, it's called idler, at frequency omega 2 such that omega 1 plus omega 2 is equal to omega 3. Again, this is simply the consequence of the energy conservation for photons. And in conventional media, where all the three refractive index are positive, all the three beams, the pump, the control beam, the signal, and the idler would co-propagate. They would propagate in the same direction because, again, that's required by the photon momentum conservation. If, again, we choose a metamaterial where refractive index for signal for beam at frequency omega 1 is negative, whereas two other refractive index are positive, then we have, again, this unusual situation when K1 and S1 look in opposite directions, and so which it means that signal would propagate against the control beam at frequency omega 3 and against the idler. So that also dramatically changes the Mandelbrot relations. But why it's all this important? Because in this case, since signal propagates against the control beam, you have a situation like in a cavity when beam counterpropagate. Because in the cavity, you have this feedback, which provided by mirrors. And here you have this similar situation, distributed feedback without any mirrors. Because in this case, your signal counter-propagates simply because of the fact that the refractive index is negative. And this is a very important feature of metamaterials. In metamaterials, we have this backward propagation. A wave start propagating in opposite direction because refractive index is negative. And because of this backwardness, if you wish, you have a feedback distribution without any cavity. And we know then that you do have a feedback, you actually have certain resonant values of lengths of the medium when you start having generation. It's exactly the situation we have in a laser. But now we have this generation without any cavity, because you have feedback simply due to the effect of this backwardness caused by the negative refractive index. And because of this, you can have certain resonant values where extremely efficient conversion of energy from the pump into signal can occur. Why all this is important? Because one of the biggest problems of metamaterials is losses. So all metamaterials which people fabricated so far are extremely lossy. We need to compensate that losses. And this nonlinear process could be the one to do this compensation, because you could take energy from the pump beam and convert it into the signal when you have this generation regime. And that results in the compensation of losses. It's also interesting to know that these two photons, the signal and idler, since they would be counter-propagating, they also would have different handedness. One would be left-handed, the one which experienced negative refractive index, another would be right-handed. Quite unusual situation, which is not known for conventional materials. You would have entangled photons, which would be counter-propagate and have different handedness. So it all indicates how nonlinear optics is new and exciting in metamaterials. I just mentioned one more process. The previous process was based on Chi2 nonlinearity, or three-photon process. But that process, to enable that process, you need to break the central symmetry. Otherwise, Chi2 would be equal zero. And in this case, you have by far more flexibility if you use Chi3 nonlinearity, which enables four-photon process, such as the one shown in this picture. Omega 1, again, is a signal. And so, let's say, you could have a control field at the frequencies. Omega 4 is signal, omega 1 and omega 3 are control beams, the beams out of which you could take energy to compensate for losses. So here you could have by far more flexibility if you introduce these nonlinear materials with Chi3 in your metamaterial with negative refractive index. Another interesting opportunity which I would like to briefly mention, in this case you can control these beams by controlling the phase. So all these parameters can be controlled through quantum interference. I'm just very briefly mentioning this because we don't have time to go into detail, and besides, you probably don't have yet the background in nonlinear optics to understand this in depth, but at least the flavor that because of negative refractive index, there is this new phenomenon of backwardness, and that results in quite unusual situation. And it, for example, enables this optical parametric amplification extremely efficient, which might be used to to compensate losses in metamaterials. So that's what I would like you to appreciate. Yes?
So do you need a source excitation with a lot of power?
Absolutely. Every time, and thank you for asking, every time I speak of this control beam, I mean that beams with lots of energy. You take energy from these control beams and control and convert it into a signal. And signal is a beam which experiences negative refractive index. And for that signal, losses are very large because that's the nature of metamaterial. But if you can take energy from the control beam and convert it into a signal, that would result you compensate for losses. Therefore, it's so important.
And so what kind of power are we talking about?
Well, that's a good question. It depends how large is nonlinearity. It also depends whether it's CW regime or pulse regime. But it's not necessarily that high. It could be, let's say, kilowatt, the power. It could be megawatt. But it depends whether it's short pulse or it's a long pulse. Or it could be even just 1 watt. It really depends on what kind of nonlinearity. People obtain nonlinear phenomena in a very extremely range of powers. And since nowadays lasers can do nearly anything, in other words, they cover all possible wavelengths, they have all the range of possible powers, pulse durations, so let's say they are quite accessible. That we don't need here something which is not accessible. We have all these lasers in any laser lab. But that's all the subject of nonlinear optics. The thing is that nothing extraordinary is required here in terms of powers of these control beams, and therefore it looks realistic. The thing is how to fabricate these large metamaterials where you could observe all these phenomena, because it's very challenging fabrication-wise. All right, we are moving to this super resolution. One of the most important applications which I mentioned in the beginning, which was enabled, has been enabled by metamaterials. And that has to do with probably one of the most fundamental applications of optics is imaging. Just microscope, using lenses, it's all about imaging. Even simple glasses we are wearing, it's also about imaging. So it turns out that there is a very fundamental thing, which is called the diffraction limit, which does not allow see details smaller than the wavelengths. where that limitation comes from. And that's actually what looks like with metamaterials could be overcome. If you look at the propagation of a beam, and just from Maxwell's equation immediately follows that kz, let's say if light propagates in z direction, can be presented by this way, where k naught is simply omega over c, and kx and ky are just transverse Fourier components which bear information about your image. And you can see here that if the details which you're looking at have size smaller than the wavelengths, it means that the corresponding Fourier components, transverse component, would be larger than omega over c. You see, if you look at, for example, at two points which are separated by 10 times smaller than the wavelengths, when you go to the k space, it would give you k vector, which is roughly 10 times larger than the omega over c, because you just go from lambda to the k space. And if the transverse wave vector kx plus ky squared larger than k naught, then you have this negative under the square root, which means that your wave would be exponentially decayed. It's evanescent. In other words, the information about small features smaller than the wavelengths have transverse vector which is larger than omega over c, and that field component exponentially decays. It is evanescent. And that's exactly the nature of this diffraction limit. With conventional lens, you cannot really image details smaller than the wavelengths. So that's what I'm emphasize here. You see that those components which bear information about this very fine features exponentially decay, and therefore you cannot see them. And what the so-called perfect lens does, introduced first by Sir John Pendry. Oh, this lens actually was introduced by Visilago, this type of lens. But Visilago has not appreciated that lens can actually image with resolution smaller than the wavelengths. And Sir John Pendry was the one who first drew attention, our attention, to the fact that actually this device could image in principle with perfect resolution. So let's say if you have objects such as this grating, okay? And let's say this is just air, refractive index plus one, and let's say you have here a slab of metamaterial with refractive index equal minus one. So, and let's say you have certain image, which it's certain, this formula just, it's Fourier decomposition, which represent this grating, okay? It just can be written this way. Then in air, the phase acquired is given by this expression, but in the material with n equal minus one, the phase would exactly compensate which the phase acquired in air, so that at this image plane, the phase would be the same as at the object plane. It looks like this negative optical space with refractive index equal minus one annihilates positive refractive, optical space with refractive index equal plus one. And in the end, you have in the image plane situation as light didn't propagate at all. You have like annihilation of positive and negative optical spaces. And therefore, you can have in the image plane absolutely ideal reconstruction in principle, if there wouldn't be any losses, any other distortion from the ideal case. Well, it turns out that this is extremely hard to realize in the far zone. Although theoretically it's all true, but experimentally it's nearly impossible, or simply impossible, because there will be exponential sensitivity to any deviation from the ideal case. And why actually there would be exponential sensitivity? Because as I pointed out, if this lattice period, if grating period is smaller than the wavelengths, those components are exponentially decaying. It means that to restore that image, you have to hear the here exponential growth. And there is this exponential growth. You could argue where this energy comes from. But that's simply because you excite the surface plasmon resonance, And since you excite surface plasmon resonance, in the course of time, you accumulate energy, and that's exactly the energy which you used to compensate for these losses. So you have this situation, first of exponential decay, then exponential increase. But every time when you're dealing with this exponential increase, it means that there is exponential sensitivity to any parameters. And therefore, if you have any small losses, that would immediately destroy all the resolution. As a result, this super lens, although in principle, theoretically, could work, but since you cannot make such perfect design with no losses, with absolutely no dispersion, in reality, it's hard to realize. However, there is, as Sir John Pendry called, so poor man's super lens, which is near-field counterpart of this. And let me explain what I mean by this. If your object is close to your lens, when I say close, I mean much smaller than the wavelengths, and the lens itself much thinner than the wavelengths, then you are in the near zone. And in the near zone, the electrical and magnetic the electrical and magnetic responses are completely decoupled. It turns out in this case, for a super lens, which requires that refractive index of your lens should be equal minus refractive index of the surrounding. For air, it's one. It means that your lens should be minus one to completely restore the phase. If it's the near zone, then in this case, the only thing which matters is epsilon. You don't need to have also mu. And so then your requirement to have epsilon equal minus epsilon h, where epsilon h is the electric permittivity of the host. For air, it would be one. But that's much easier to do. Then you could tweak just metal, such as silver, and find the frequency at which it equal minus one, if it's in air. And then you can realize this resolution, sub-wavelength resolution, but that would be limited to the near zone only. That was suggested also by Sir John Pendry and realized experimentally by Shang Zheng group at UCLA and independently by Richard Blakey in New Zealand. And Professor Schwetz at UT Austin realized it for mid-infrared. So that's a famous, they use this nano as a lens, they use this thin silver slab, and you see they image this words nano from here to here. So this is object, this is image. And the resolution was deeply sub-wavelengths. Well, this slide emphasizes the difference between three lenses. So in the ordinary lens, again, those Fourier components which bear information about very fine details, smaller than the wavelength, they exponentially decay, as opposed to other components which bear information about structures larger than the wavelength. Those are propagating. In super lens, what you do, you regrow those components which were exponentially decayed. You see, evanescent field is enhanced. However, decays away from lens again, exponentially. And the problem with this super lens that it's basically very sensitive to any deviation from the required condition. And as a result, it's limited only to the near zone. In reality, you cannot really make a super lens working in the far zone. There is a recent development which has been accomplished by Professor Narimanov, who is my colleague, working in his office actually in this building, and he suggested this idea of hyperlens. And hyperlens is a very smart idea, and so people now working hard to realize this hyperlens for different spectral ranges. And in the case of hyperlens, what happened, instead of exponentially increasing these components which bear information about fine details, they are converted into propagating components. That's a very, very smart idea. And that was suggested independently, as I said, by Professor Narimanov's group and by Professor Ngeta's group. They nearly simultaneously published the same idea. And here you could see this beautiful hyperlens. It actually consists of these concentric layers of metal and dielectric. And in principle, you could image very fine objects, such as DNA here shown. That, and you could, and this is a hyperlens. If you place inside of this small object, you could image it in the diffuson in this case, and see it with resolution way beyond the wavelength limit, beyond the diffraction limit. And here you could see the first experimental realization of the hyperlens. And actually, it happened only 6 months roughly after the idea was proposed. And it was again happened simultaneously in two groups. One group is Dr. Smolyaninov, who actually was here a month ago. So he obtained this hyperlens for surface plasmon polaritons. Again, it was not for light, it was for surface plasmon polaritons. He made this concentric layer of polymer on a metal film, and he was the object, and he showed that this hyperlens can indeed resolve sub-wavelength features. The other thing I want to emphasize, hyperlens as opposed to superlens, it magnifies. So first your feature is smaller than the wavelengths, but then it magnifies. It, in other words, it brings it from the domain, sub-wavelengths domain, sub-diffraction limit, to the domain when it's larger than the wavelength, so that you could image it with conventional microscope. That's very important. So eventually you look at something much smaller than the wavelengths, but you magnify it, and then you can image it with conventional optics. And Professor Zhang at UCLA demonstrated this hyperlens by making these layers of silver and dielectric, and in that case, he imaged these words on. So again, with deeply sub-wavelength resolution. So this is a very exciting development, and people working now very hard to make new types of hyperlens. All these hyperlens so far, they're kind of concentric. It would be absolutely beautiful, for example, to create flat hyperlens. Then you could use it just a standard add-on to conventional microscope. With microscope, you cannot see features smaller than the wavelengths. Imagine that you create this hyperlens, just add to microscope, all of a sudden would start seeing features much smaller than the wavelengths. That would be absolutely revolutionary. You would be able to see biological molecules, many important things, just with light. So if it will be accomplished, and that's what we're working hard on in my group, in other groups, that would be absolutely great breakthrough for the whole area of optics. And this, therefore, I think this is one of the most spectacular applications of metamaterials. And speaking of this, I already mentioned that this slides illustrate this idea. Dr. Kildyshev, also from my group, and Professor Narimanov recently improved this hyperlens theoretically. They showed that you can make this hyperlens, which would be impedance matched, meaning that throughout the throughput would be much, much larger. So you could see that with conventional hyperlens, very little light actually goes from the source. The source is somewhere inside. If you slightly redesign it, not slightly actually, but significantly, so you could make it impedance matched so that lots of light goes out. That's very recent development. They just published it in the end of last year, Alex Kildyshev and Evgeny Narimanov. And again, with Alex Kildyshev, only this January, we proposed this development when you can make it like semi-flat hyperlens in this case. Because you see, in this case, this is my object. We see two sources, which are separated by distance smaller than the wavelength. This is hyperlens then magnifies the image. And here you have above the distance above the wavelength. So you could see it with conventional microscope. And the important thing, this is flat. That's what I'm talking about. That to accomplish in the end flat hyperlens, that would be of extreme importance. So this is just, we're in the very beginning of this field. Our group and other groups actively working here, and we hope that within a year or two or three, we would have tremendous progress here, which, as I said, could dramatically affect the way we image objects now, the way we see objects. Well, that's actually concludes this part of metamaterial series. And next time, we will consider perhaps the most exciting area of related to metamaterials, which is called transformation optics. By saying this, I mean that You can actually mold the flow of light. You can control light. You can make light propagate not along the straight lines as light normally does, but actually you can curve the space for light. You can create areas where light is concentrated or completely excluded, enabling so-called cloaking. This is a very fascinating possibility. And that's, many believe, going to be the future. So that's what people will be busy for the next perhaps 5 years or so. So thank you, and I'll see you next week.